Perhaps you know the feeling of coming home from the great outdoors to discover a tick on your body, the feelings of disgust, fear, and sickness it can bring. I'm Suzanne Hogan. This is Central Standard on KCUR. Today on the program, we'll learn about the various ticks in our region, the diseases they carry, and ways you can protect yourself. And in the second half of the hour, I know I prefer not to talk to anybody else before I have my first cup of coffee in the morning. Caffeine can truly make or break my day. Are you a caffeine addict? We'll learn about the science and cultural impact of the world's most commonly used psychoactive drug, caffeine. Stay with us for Central Standard after this hour's news. It's never fun to come home after enjoying the outdoors to find that a tick has latched onto your body. Ticks love to jump onto hosts and suck their blood. It's how they survive. They live off of the blood of mammals, birds, and sometimes even reptiles and amphibians. Their bites can cause irritation and pass on diseases. In the United States, ticks are responsible for more human diseases than any other insect. Good morning. This is Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. Today on the show, we'll learn about the ticks in our region and the diseases they carry. We'll hear about the latest research on the most recently identified tick-borne virus that was discovered in Missouri last summer, the Heartland virus, plus discuss ways you can prevent exposure to ticks in our area. Later on in the second half of the hour, a historical and scientific look at caffeine usage, the world's most commonly used psychoactive drug. But first, I'm joined by Dr. Scott Folk, Director of Adult Infectious Diseases at Heartland Regional Medical Center in St. Joseph, Missouri. Dr. Folk, welcome to Central Standard. Good morning.
My pleasure, Suzanne. It's good to be with you.
Dr. Folk, you got a lot of press last year with your role in the identification of a new tick-borne virus that was later named the Heartland virus, which came from ticks in Missouri. What was your role in the identification of that new virus?
Well, that story actually begins back in Tallahassee, Florida, when I was practicing there in the late 90s. I began seeing a few patients every spring who had been bitten by ticks and subsequently developed ehrlichiosis. I forwarded blood samples to the CDC in Atlanta for Ehrlichia testing, and subsequently the CDC came to Tallahassee to collect ticks from the very fields where these patients had been bitten.
And just quickly, what is ehrlichiosis?
Ehrlichiosis is a tick-borne infection transmitted by Lone Star ticks and results in humans in a constellation of symptoms, including fever and chills and headaches and fatigue and certain key laboratory abnormalities. So then moving forward to June of 2009, I saw two farmers from northwestern Missouri who I thought had ehrlichiosis. They were hospitalized at Heartland Regional Medical Center in St. Joseph for fever and chills, fatigue, and the key laboratory abnormalities. But they were very slow to get better with doxycycline. And doxycycline is the drug of choice for ehrlichiosis, but these patients were very slow to get better. And moreover, testing at CDC in Atlanta revealed that they were indeed negative for Ehrlichia. But through a process called next-generation sequencing and electron microscopy at the CDC, the Heartland virus was identified.
How apparent was it at that time that the tick was the culprit? How were you able to identify that that's what the commonality was between these two patients?
Both of our patients had been bitten by ticks in the few weeks leading up to their hospitalization. And the CDC in Fort Collins, Colorado, is currently conducting studies to determine if ticks are indeed the vector, as we suspect.
So how is Heartland virus different from ehrlichiosis?
Ehrlichiosis, yes. Ehrlichiosis is a small intracellular bacterium, whereas Heartland virus is just that. It's a virus. So what that means from a practical standpoint is that ehrlichiosis can be treated with an antibiotic such as doxycycline, whereas as of the moment, there's no specific therapy for Heartland virus infections.
How many people have been diagnosed with Heartland virus?
Two at the moment.
And so your research since then has been focused on what, since these two patients have been identified as having Heartland virus? Where are we at now?
We have a study ongoing that's being conducted by the CDC in Fort Collins, Colorado, to try to identify patients when they walk in the hospital with suspected Harlan virus infection. So as of the moment, the only way to get tested for Harlan virus infection is if patients qualify for entry into the study. At the moment, the study is being conducted at Heartland Regional in St. Joseph, as well as a hospital in Maryville, Missouri, here in Kansas City, in Jefferson City. So those are the key areas right now where we're looking.
And this is the only region where Heartland virus has popped up?
Yes, but we're looking to see where else Heartland virus might be found. And I'm aware that there's some other research going on in other parts of the country to try to answer that question, where else Heartland virus might be found in other patients, for example.
Like where?
Well, I believe that research is being conducted right now in Texas and other parts of the country, so we'll have to see what comes of that.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. We're talking about ticks in our area, and we're going to talk about the Heartland virus more and other diseases that ticks in our area carry. But first, I was thinking we could just back up and get some tick basics. What are ticks, basically, and how are they different from other insects?
Well, ticks, like spiders, are arachnids. They have four pairs of legs, and they don't fly or jump. Remember the film back in 1990, Arachnophobia? Fleas and mosquitoes are insects. They have three pairs of legs. So ticks begin their life as an egg. The egg hatches, release, and a six-legged larva emerges. The larva then takes a blood meal, molts, and becomes a nymph with eight legs. And then the nymph, in turn, takes a blood meal, molts, and becomes an adult with eight legs. The life cycle can take up to about 3 years. Most ticks die because they just simply are unable to find a host for their next blood meal.
And so that's how they survive, is by living off of blood.
That's right. Whether it's a human or whether it's an animal, it doesn't matter to them.
How are they different from other types of insects that live off of blood?
Well, they have a predilection for biting humans, as we said, and transmitting certain key illnesses. The kinds of infections that, for instance, mosquitoes transmit, like West Nile, for example, or malaria, for example, are very different from the types of infections that are transmitted by ticks.
Like how so?
Well, as we said, ticks can transmit things like Lyme disease. Lyme disease is the most common tick-borne illness in the United States. But ticks can also transmit ehrlichiosis. We suspect Heartland virus. They can transmit another infection called tularemia, Rocky Mountain spotted femur, and so forth, anaplasmosis, babesiosis, and so forth.
So I'm coming from probably a bit of a biased perspective here, but I've often wondered, being having had found ticks on my body before, what are ticks really good for anyways? I mean, what role do they serve in the ecosystem?
Well, ticks, I'm not a true tick expert in that sense of the word, but from my perspective on the world, ticks are important because they can potentially transmit infections to humans, and that's where I get involved with them.
Hmm. So is there a reason why the region we're in right now has more ticks than others?
Well, ticks are seasonal, and right now, there's a lot of nymphs out. As far as Lone Star ticks, I should back up a step and point out that back in June of 2009, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, came to Missouri to look at the kinds of ticks that were most prevalent. And it was an interesting study because they found that 97% of adult ticks and 99.9% of nymphal ticks were Lone Star ticks. Scientifically, we call them Amblyomma americanum. So these particular kinds of ticks that are so plentiful in Missouri. Right now, this time of year, the nymphs are the predominant part of the life cycle that's out, nymphs and to a lesser extent adults. So as we said, ticks are seasonal. The nymphs are out looking for a host to obtain blood so that they can molt and develop into an adult. In June and July, the tick numbers are really at their maximum. And then in the late summer and early fall, it's largely the larvae that come out as far as the Lone Star ticks are concerned. Other types of ticks, like, for instance, the black-legged tick that transmit Lyme disease, they have a little bit different life cycle. But for the most plentiful tick here in Missouri, the Lone Star tick, that's the life cycle.
And what type of climates do the Lone Star tick like, and where do they like to hang out?
Well, they like to they're typically found in at the edge of wooded areas, in woods and brushy areas. So it's important that you try to limit your risk when you go walking into those kind of areas, especially at this time of year between April and September. To try to, as far as tick prevention is concerned, it's important to do frequent tick checks, to think about putting on a tick repellent such as DEET, 20 or 30% DEET on exposed skin, or to apply permethrin to clothing, to your socks. Make sure that you tuck your pant legs into your socks. As we said, do frequent tick checks. And consider, once you come indoors, consider showering within an hour or two to try to wash off any ticks. Some people put their clothes in the dryer because the heat helps to remove the ticks from clothing. And if you do find an embedded tick, it's important to try to remove the tick with tweezers. Don't try to remove it with your fingers. Try to remove it with your tweezers and pull it straight out.
Well, so, yeah, and that's kind of jumping ahead. I wanted to talk about the different ways that people think you should remove ticks. I've heard conflicting things growing up. You know, get a match and burn it, burn the body so it'll let go, and then pull it with tweezers. Is that effective? I mean, what is the proper way to get rid of a tick? And then should we hold on to our ticks after we take them off of our bodies?
No, there's no real value in holding on to a tick once it's been removed. I think the key is when you remove a tick, as I said, to remove it with tweezers and pull it straight out. So you try not to let any of the embedded segments behind. Keep in mind also that when ticks bite, not all people will know that they have a tick on them, because there's a bit of anesthetic material in the tick's saliva that would hinder your ability to know that you've been actually bitten by the tick. And the ticks are looking for dark areas of skin that with skin folds. So they're typically found, for instance, along the hairline or in the creases in the thigh or groin, behind your knees, for example. So those are the key areas to look at.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. We're talking about ticks in our area with Dr. Scott Folk. Have you noticed ticks around your home? What are you doing to keep yourself protected? Any questions about ticks you've always wanted to ask, 816-235-2888, or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org, or tweet us at KCURCST. That's 816-235-2888. And so we talked about the Lone Star tick earlier. What does the Lone Star tick look like?
Well, the adult, again, for the life cycle of the ticks, keep in mind that there's the larva, the nymph, and the adult. The Lone Star adult female typically has a white dot on her back. The adult male and the nymphs do not have such a white dot on their back. So the adult females are fairly easy to recognize in that sense. But they, by far, are the most plentiful kind of tick here in Missouri. Not the only ones, but the most common.
So them being the most common, what diseases do they carry?
Lone Star ticks transmit ehrlichiosis, tularemia, another infection called Southern Tick Associated Rash Illness, or STARI for short. We suspect that they also may transmit Heartland virus.
We have a caller who asked, Tom asks if numbness is a symptom of a tick-borne illness.
It can be after a period of time, not immediately, not within days of a tick bite, but for instance, Lyme disease can cause, after several weeks or months, can cause various neurologic manifestations. So that potentially could happen, but not right away.
And I imagine the symptoms vary from virus to virus, but what are some of the symptoms of tick-borne diseases?
Well, in general, tick-borne illnesses are associated with fever and chills, headaches and achy muscles, fatigue. Some but not all tick-borne illnesses are associated with rash. Some but not all are associated with an ulcer or swollen lymph nodes.
So you work a lot with patients who come in and have just who have a tick-borne disease or a tick-borne illness. Is that correct? Or are they not sure that they have something yet? They've just been bit by a tick and don't know what to do.
Most have been recall having been bitten by a tick maybe 10, 14, 21 days ago, and subsequently they get sick and come into the hospital for these kind of symptoms, fever, chills, headaches, fatigue. And then they have certain key laboratory abnormalities that are many times a good tip-off for the presence of a tick-borne infection. Those include three things, primarily a low white blood cell count, a low platelet count, and abnormal liver tests.
So what are some of the first things you do to determine what exactly you're looking at as far as which disease you're looking at here?
Well, we keep an open mind and obtain cultures of blood, cultures of urine to look for other potential kinds of infections if they come in with a fever. We ask them, we take a careful history and ask about when they were exposed to ticks and how many ticks that they've had and how they removed those ticks. We ask about the presence of any rash and any other neurologic symptoms or ulcers or swollen lymph glands. We examine them for those things as well. And then for laboratory studies, we do blood counts to look for the low blood white blood cell count and platelet count, and the liver test is what we're looking at. Go ahead.
Oh, no. Well, how does how you remove a tick maybe make a difference?
Well, again, if you remove the tick with your fingers, you're more likely to let a segment of the tick behind, and so that increases the risk of potentially have a tick-borne infection.
Oh, so by how much?
Nobody knows for sure.
Okay. So leaving any bit of the tick inside your body will just increase the probability that you could get sick.
The risk, yes. You want to try to remove the tick in its entirety when you find it.
So what are some of the biggest challenges you face in diagnosing people? Because people come in probably saying, oh, I have this, I have that. And that you're trying to look at what actually is the physical state that they're in. I mean, is it kind of a challenge to actually come to a diagnosis?
Well, some of the challenges include that not everyone is able to recall having had a tick bite. People can come in with a tick-borne illness and not recall having had a tick bite. Another challenge is that not everyone who does have a tick-borne illness was healthy to begin with. Some of them are already severely immunosuppressed by virtue of, for example, an underlying cancer or chemotherapy or radiation therapy or HIV or AIDS, for example. So all those things play into the ultimate severity and the types of symptoms that they manifest by having a tick-borne illness.
So what kind of treatment is there, like medication?
Most but not all of the tick-borne illnesses in the U.S. are readily treated with antibiotics, notably doxycycline, as we mentioned. And doxycycline, too, is not an innocuous drug. It can have certain side effects that you need to be wary of as well. For instance, doxycycline can cause photosensitivity, exaggerated tendency to develop sunburn. So we warn people to put plenty of sunblock on when they go outside, especially at this time of year. If doxycycline is not taken with water and washed entirely down the esophagus, it can burn a hole, so to speak, in the esophagus. It can cause abnormal liver tests and so forth. So it's something to think about.
We're talking about – oh, go ahead.
Well, so as I said, most of the tick-borne illnesses in the U.S. are treatable with an antibiotic such as doxycycline, and there are other antibiotics as well that can be used. But as we said, for heartland virus, right now there is no specific therapy for it. The treatment is all supportive.
Are there any vaccines?
There was a vaccine several years ago for Lyme disease that was subsequently withdrawn from the market. But there is no vaccine right now for heartland virus.
We're talking about ticks here on KCUR on Central Standard. I'm Suzanne Hogan with Dr. Scott Folk. We're going to hear from Judy in Lee's Summit. She called 816-235-2888. Judy, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi. Thank you so much. And thank you, sir, for being there. I seem to be a tick magnet. And most of the ticks I get are the little teeny tiny deer ticks. What do they carry other than using DEET, which I try to remember? Should I watch for? Should I do? I usually find them within 24 hours, and I must be really allergic to them because that bite will itch 3 weeks.
Mm. It'll itch for 3 weeks?
Yes.
Thanks for your call. Those are good comments. The tick saliva sometimes can contain irritating substances that can cause localized pain or itching that can go on for a little while. And if you happen to be allergic to some of the components within the tick saliva, that's only going to promote the itching. In terms of your earlier question about deer ticks and what do they transmit, deer ticks are otherwise known as black-legged ticks. Scientifically, we call them Ixodes scapularis. Ixodes scapularis and Ixodes pacificus, another tick found in the western U.S., most notably transmit Lyme disease. But these deer ticks also transmit an infection called anaplasmosis, which is relatively uncommon here in Missouri, but it's much more plentiful, much more common in the upper Midwest and in the Northeast. And these particular ticks also transmit another infection that's found commonly in the Northeast, which is babesiosis. So Lyme disease, anaplasmosis, and babesiosis are the three types of infections that those deer ticks transmit. And importantly, the most common tick here, the Lone Star tick, does not transmit Lyme disease.
Judy, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling.
Oh, well, I do have one other question. My husband and I can walk side by side through the same area, and he doesn't get any, and I come in with two.
I've been wondering this question also, Judy. Dr. Scott Folk?
That's a good question. Ticks are attracted to people through a variety of mechanisms. It's a combination usually of our body heat, our body motion, and the carbon dioxide, the CO2 that we exhale. All of those things tend to attract ticks. But why certain people are affected more than others is still a bit elusive. Some of that could have to do with particular types of materials that's found on their skin, any certain chemicals that are found on the skin that ticks find more attractive for one person than another. But that carbon dioxide, when people exhale carbon dioxide, that's an important point, because when the CDC has come to town to collect ticks, as they have now numerous times, one of the tricks, if you will, that they use to collect ticks is to use blocks of dry ice. They put blocks of dry ice in a plastic container with a hole in the lid. And it's the, of course, dry ice sublimates. It turns into a gas.
Sure.
It doesn't turn into a liquid. And the gas that's released is carbon dioxide, and it's the CO2 that attracts the ticks. So they can literally sit there and watch the ticks come crawling to them, to the blocks of dry ice.
And you've been at some of those, correct?
Oh, yes.
What does it look like to see all those ticks just coming out from, you know, the woodwork?
The CDC is very effective in gathering ticks. They use a combination of dry cloths and dry ice. And last August, when they were out, they collected, I believe it was upwards of 30,000 ticks within a week.
Wow.
So the carbon dioxide is a very effective technique to recover ticks. So don't underestimate the CO2 that you exhale.
Judy, thanks for the call. So how are you working with the CDC?
I've continued to send samples to them from patients whom I believe have ehrlichiosis. And in addition, then we have this study ongoing, as I mentioned earlier, in partnership with the CDC in Fort Collins, Colorado, to identify patients with potential Heartland virus infection.
And then how did the Heartland virus get the name the Heartland virus? Because it originally wasn't called that. When it first was popping up, it didn't have a name. We were still trying to figure out.
Well, we had to name it. Once we discovered it, then the next question was, what are we going to name this? And in conversation with the CDC, we decided that Heartland virus would be a good name because, two reasons, actually. One, because St. Joseph is in the middle of the Midwest, the Heartland, if you will, the United States. And secondly, because the seminal cases were identified at Heartland Regional Medical Center in St. Joe.
Is there a sense of pride that you have there with that being named after where you work?
There is. I mean, it's very exciting to be part of a discovery of a new virus that's never been seen before, ever, and to have it named for the region of the U.S. where I live and work, as well as to be able to partner with a group like the CDC in this whole project has been personally very rewarding for me.
We're talking about ticks here on KCUR and Central Standard. I'm Suzanne Hogan. We're going to hear now from Paul. Paul, welcome to Central Standard.
Oh, thank you. My question is, I was curious, what is the visual difference between a nymph and adult?
Dr.
And I'll take my answer. Pardon?
Oh, yeah, go ahead, Dr. Foltz.
Okay.
Oh.
Okay. The nymphs are primarily out right now. The nymphs are a little larger than the larva, but they're just a little smaller than the adults. They look like mini adults, if you will. But the Lone Star...
But compared to what? I mean, they're so tiny already. I mean, can you give us a size?
They are. They are very tiny. They have, like I said, they have 8 legs. The adult female, the Lone Star female, has a white dot on her back. And if you actually go to the CDC's website, cdc.gov, and then type in ticks, they've got all kinds of pictures there where you can see these kinds of ticks that we've been talking about this morning. So that'll give you, I think, a better visual picture than I could ever give you verbally.
Earlier when you were talking about what ticks are attracted to with Judy's call, is that similar to mosquitoes as well?
A little different. Mosquitoes have other things that attract them to people. And I'm not a mosquito expert, but I know that there are differences between them.
So getting back to the Heartland virus, there are some similarities with the Heartland virus to SFTS, an emerging infection in Southeastern Asia. What is SFTS and what is the significance of these similarities?
That's a good question. SFTS stands for severe fever with thrombocytopenia syndrome. Thrombocytopenia, in a nutshell, means low platelet count. Platelets are small cells in your blood that normally help you form a clot so you don't bleed to death when you cut yourself. And severe fever with thrombocytopenia syndrome virus was first described in China in 2009. The virus is transmitted by ticks, and the Chinese also believe that it is transmitted person to person via the blood. The mortality rate is thought to be about 30%. Like Heartland virus, severe fever with thrombocytopenia syndrome virus belongs to the bunyavirus family. It's an RNA-containing virus. And within that family of viruses, there's a group of viruses called fleboviruses. And both Heartland virus and severe fever with thrombocytopenia syndrome are fleboviruses.
What's a flebovirus?
A flebovirus is nothing more than a type of RNA-containing virus, a bunyavirus, that is transmitted by ticks. And up until severe fever with thrombocytopenia syndrome virus, there was no other virus, tick-borne flebovirus, that caused disease in humans. But now Heartland virus is the second in that category.
So how are you or the CDC working internationally to figure out what the significance of these similarities are?
Well, the CDC is keeping a close eye on the situation in China, and there are reports coming out all the time in the medical literature about the spread, if you will, of this virus in China and now perhaps into other parts of Southeast Asia as well.
So we're about to wrap up here, but after this conversation, I mean, I enjoy spending time outdoors. And after hearing all these things, it kind of makes it, you know, make me not as thrilled to spend time hiking. I mean, what kind of words do you have for people who want to go out and enjoy the outdoors, but stay protected and prevent becoming a host or infecting with a disease?
I'll tell you, Suzanne, my wife and 12-year-old son, the three of us live in St. Joe, and my son loves to spend his summer days going out trekking in the woods. So what we tell him is to wear long pants, to tuck his pants into his socks, and we will frequently put permethrin on his socks.
And what is permethrin?
Permethrin is a chemical that you can buy in most camping stores or that kind of thing. And you don't put it on the skin. That's an important point. But you spray it on clothing. It holds up to about 5 or 6 washings, and it helps to retard ticks from questing and attaching to you. So it's very effective. When our son comes back from the woods, we do tick checks, and we have the tweezers at the ready to remove any embedded ticks. So that's worked pretty well.
Dr. Scott Folk, thank you so much for joining us on Central Standard today, and keep us posted on the research that you're doing up at Heartland Regional Medical Center.
I've enjoyed it. Thanks for the opportunity.
Dr. Scott Folk is the Director of Adult Infectious Diseases at Heartland Regional Medical Center in St. Joseph, Missouri. We're going to take a break. When we come back, whether it's coffee, tea, or cola, whatever gives you your fix, We'll learn about the world's most commonly used psychoactive drug, caffeine. I'm Suzanne Hogan. Central Standard returns in just a moment.